Accession number 7310, roll number 12.
Take 12. You were explaining about the cavalry and their function during the war. Did they ever have the opportunity to make one of their old-fashioned charges?
I think were they not used at the Battle of Cambrai? I can't quite remember. And they were certainly used at the in the early stages of the war. But I think as the war progressed and opportunities lessened, they found they were really wasting so much time looking after their horses in the behind the lines, outside the firing zone, that they became almost mentally immobile. And I'm not sure, not being an authority on the subject, whether they were used again or not. The impression I have was that they gradually realized that the tank was going to take over from them, which of course happened in the future. Armored vehicles. So I think they were the first to realize that as the war progressed, they were of less and less importance. But I can't now remember whether they were used to pursue the Germans in their retreat, as they could have been and could well have been in the final stages of World War I. That I'm not sure about.
I'd now like to ask you a little more about the relationships between the men, the other ranks, and the officers. From what you've described so far, you were obviously very attached to your Durham miners. When you were with your first battery, I wonder if we could sort of look in rather greater detail at relations between men and officers. Did you find that as you were with a team for any length of time, you developed closer relations with them?
It was extraordinary. I never thought it might happen. In my first training in the army, I looked on myself as just almost a machine in charge of so many lesser machines which I had to connect up with to make them function. And then as I got into closer contact with both officers and men in the hubbub of war, and the tragedies and the successes of it, we became more, we found ourselves thinking more and more in terms of a family. And I know in 36 Siege Battery, I think more so than any other, the family spirit was perfectly extraordinary. And I give all the credit to Major A.C.H. Dean, who was an instructor in gunnery and was a commander of the battery from the beginning until he got invalided home in the middle of the Somme. He was a charming man and everybody loved him, officers and men alike, and he's a very efficient battery commander, although he might be criticized for staying in the battery position nearly all through the Somme, while we junior officers had to go out and do the dangerous part, which was the forward observation work, sometimes even going into no man's land if we couldn't see from our own front line. It turned out very well because he was splendid at the gunnery side of it, and of course the battery command post was the best position for him under the circumstances, and I think it was only right that we should do all the mobile work, so to speak, in the forward areas. So it worked very well, and I think those who were in contact with him got to like him very much indeed, and he created what you might call an extremely happy battery. And although war is a very serious thing, it does have its humorous moments. And I remember, for instance, on one occasion in Alba, when we were in action at the beginning of the Somme, in a lovely garden, which had been the garden of a lovely chateau on the east side of Alba, and we were constantly shelled. And one shell burst underneath our water cart. Each battery had its own water cart, and the water points were provided here and there in the forward zone, and we all had to go and collect our water requirements in these carts and manhandle them back to the battery. And so it was rather a precious thing. And on one occasion, a shell burst right under this water cart, blew it right up into the air, and it crashed down all in a crumple underneath, and we all men and of burst out laughing. It was so funny to see the disaster that had happened to our water cart. And occasionally things like that. Another thing happened when we were shelled further forward. It was very muddy, awfully muddy, and a shell burst in the battery position, and it so happened that the battery idiot. Every battery has its idiot. We had one in our battery, and the battery idiot happened to be walking behind the guns. I think he was on some errand of some kind with a tin helmet on, and a shell burst. He took no notice whatever the shell about the shell, and that happened to most of us then. Didn't care what happened. The shell burst, and instead of hitting him, it threw up a whole splutter of mud and lumps of earth and muck and things. And one of these lumps of mud fell squat on the top of his tin helmet and stuck there. He'd no idea what had happened. He went on walking, looking this way and that, and the whole battery burst out laughing at the most comical sight of seeing this so-called idiot walking about looking so funny. It was really very most amusing. So there were fun experiences like that.
Do you think that the officers had a very different lifestyle at the front from the men?
Yes, I'm sorry to think we did, and I think that was greatly improved in World War One, in World War Two. For instance, in World War One, we nearly all had our camp beds, and it was almost de rigueur with our batmen to rig up the officer's camp bed in any suitable place he could find, and the best place he could find. And of course the poor men hadn't anything else, but when we could, we used to rig up wire bunks, or we took over wire bunks from the dugouts, from the German dugouts, and in a good battery position where there are plenty of dugouts, the men mostly could have a stretch on a wire bed below ground where they were quite safe, moderately safe. And we officers had to do the same in the position at O'Villa's that we went to once, which was a very hot position near Thiepval. Although I did live in... the awful thing about dugouts was that they were infested with rats, and they were dreadful things. I couldn't tolerate them. So I remember when we officers were sleeping, four or five of us, in a German, ex-German dugout below ground. The men were all accommodated similarly. I woke up one day, I knew the rats were about, and I saw a wretched one at the bottom of my bed looking at me, just ready to pounce. And I got out my revolver and shot at it. Of course I missed. And do you know, I asked the officers the next morning at breakfast, had they heard my revolver shoot? And they were all taken by surprise. They were so done in that they just slept and didn't matter what noises were going on, so I was rather amused at that.
Were you plagued with fleas as well as rats?
Did I?
Did you have fleas?
No, fortunately not. We kept very clear, and I don't think I mean ever suffered from lice or fleas, except on that terrible occasion in La Huswa, which they call Lousy, when we did have fleas and we had to get rid of them. But once we got rid of those, we knew what to expect in German farm houses, if we ever, I mean French farm houses, if we ever came to them. But we didn't often have that privilege later. But there were delousing centres behind the lines where men got into a sort of canister tub affair of hot water and had a hot bath in this canister. Then they got into another sort of thing, I don't know what it was, and there's canvas all around them, and canvas screens, and they were deloused and given a new set of clothing. I can't ever remember that happening to our battery, but it happened a great deal with the infantry, poor things, who couldn't avoid them in the front line. But we managed to keep ourselves moderately clean except for mud, and that was awful. It got in everywhere.
Were you pleased to have your batman to look after you? No, did it mean much to you to have someone to look after your comfort?
Yes, it was marvellous, because they were wonderful friends, and the batman were very carefully chosen. A lot of them had been in service, footmen and others, so they knew what it was to serve somebody, and they served us magnificently. I remember one, the Major's batman was a gunner called Hampshire, and when the Major was invalided home in October, I think it was 1916, he handed Hampshire over to me, which was very kind of him. And Hampshire was a marvellously attentive person. He sought my every comfort that he could think of. And he rigged up my bunk, whatever it was, most carefully. And always sought it when I came home, all covered with mud from the forward observation post, got it inside my boots and everything. He took it all away, and what he did with it I don't know, but the next morning I appeared again in quite a smart uniform, polished buttons and all like that. Was of course awful in those days, but we all had to wear our polished buttons and Sam Brown belts and all very tidily, and he kept me marvellously tidy, and we became great friends. And that was often the case, and my diaries tell of I became so attached to my family, it really was, the personnel of the battery, that I declined quite a number of offers to get promotion or to get a better job or something. And I was so glad when I got back to the battery again. On one occasion, I know I was to be posted to another battery with a view to becoming a captain, and acting captain. Captain, I was so glad when I managed to get a cancelled cert. I remained lieutenant with 36 siege battery. So we were a very happy family together, officers and men.
How did you fare regarding food at the front? You mentioned this one occasion when you had that lovely mess dinner. I imagine that didn't happen too frequently.
Oh, it did happen occasionally, because after all, if we wanted a meal, wanted anything to eat up at the forward observation, we had to produce our own. And we all had what were called iron rations in those days, which were as hard as iron. Biscuits and things, but we didn't often use them. But when we went forward, we used to have tins of bully meat and that kind of thing. And we carried them in our haversacks. And sometimes we could fry up a bit of bully or something on a stove. I've still got the methylated stove, at least I think I have somewhere, that I used to carry about with me on the Somme. And it was a methylated spirit thing with a tiny little sort of saucepan thing with a cover on top. And I used to use that for in the OP for boiling up or frying up or whatever it was, and my own food and that kind of thing. And I think we mostly fended for ourselves in that kind of way, in a very primitive way. But when we got back, we had the full ration, of course. And there was meat of some kind. I can't think where it came from. I think very often we officers bought some meat from the French farmers and cooked it, had it cooked, and that kind of thing. But the men were adequately provided with quite good rations, and it was de rigueur that we saw that they were well fed.
Would you have had vegetables or fruit at any time?
No. Nothing like that. I think everything was really tinned, unless we bought it ourselves from shops and things like we did sometimes for the officers' mess in places like Amiens and Doulon. And I remember in O'Villa's, in our battery position there, we bought a camembert cheese, and the officers couldn't stand the smell of it or something, so it had to be hidden and put away. And for some reason, as the winter progressed, and we were month after month in that dugout, the smell got appalling, and we thought, dead rats, where are they? What's happened? Like that. And then when we had to demolish the dugout, keep the precious corrugated iron roof we put on top of it, to build another mess in the new position, we saw the remains of the camembert cheese shoved it in behind the rafters. So that wasn't a very happy occasion.
Were the men allocated with a ration of rum at the front?
I can't remember a ration of rum. I think there may have been. I think there was a ration of rum on Christmas days, but I don't think on other occasions.
Did you ever witness any of the punishments which were meted out to the men, such as field punishment number one, or anything else?
I can't remember anything about punishments. There must have been some punishments. In fact, I know my diaries record about... my having to punish a man for doing something. But if I remember right, our policy was to make the punishment fit the crime. And if the chap, shall we say, had allowed himself to get dirty, well, we bury his face in the mud, shall we say, well, this is figuratively speaking, to make it even dirtier still, until he got so fed up with himself that he never got dirty again. That's the kind of attitude that we try to adopt, and I always did adopt in the army with some very amusing results at times.
Can you think of any?
Do you want me to tell you one of the funniest things I remember about it? Between the wars, does that matter?
I think I ought to keep to the First World War, if you could think of anything there.
I can't remember now punishments. They rather went out of my memory, I'm glad to say. But I do remember the happier moments rather than the... there were very, very few, because our men were extremely loyal and devoted to their officers as we were to them, and they worked like slaves at all times, and that, I think, is what got 36th Battery such a well-known name along the section of the front where it was. So well-known that two generals came on separate occasions to say that they had chosen our battery, they had forbidden any other batteries to shoot at proximity shoots, as they were called, machine guns and Minenwerfers, very near the front line, 50 yards or 100 yards away from our front line, except our own 36 siege battery. And that kept our picker up, and we thought, jolly good, here we are, off we go again, kind of thing.
You have mentioned in your previous remarks that you were very fortunate regarding casualties, that you only experienced one in your 36 siege battery, is that right?
Yes.
And one with your Bosch Buster battery.
Now it comes back to me, I think we did have two or three or four in 36 siege battery, but I only remember one casualty in Bosch Buster.
When you had these casualties, did you have the responsibility of attending to the casualty or notifying the relatives? Were you ever left in that position?
Oh yes, no. We had to deal with first aid to them until aid arrived, and Red Cross ambulance thing, section very far away. And when there were casualties in our case, it was only a few minutes before the semi-trained casualty detachment in the battery bandaged them up and gave them first aid, and then handed them over on a stretcher to the next stage behind the line, so to speak, and then eventually the bad ones fetched up at the casualty clearing stations. That was a general routine, but we had to be able to deal with we all had a first aid kit on us. We had to be able to use it. We were trained to use it.
Could you cope with that yourself? Did you find you were able to dress wounds and deal with these things?
I had to. On one occasion, when shortly after the outbreak of the Somme, we were in our position in that garden in Albert, and I was sleeping on the ground floor of a little house which had been demolished. But the ground floor was made watertight by my batman, and I had my camp bed put there. Others were sleeping in the basement down below, which was in a high escarpment sort of thing. And there's a 12-inch howitzer railway howitzer, only about 50 or 100 yards away from the billet, and one night the Germans caught it. And it so happened, it was not only on the rail line, there was a road bridge going over the line nearby, and there was an ammunition train going up to the field batteries in the forward zone. When I say train, I don't mean a railway train, but it was the name given to the whatever the system was of conveying ammunition forward. In this case, it was a team of horse-drawn horses conveying ammunition wagons forward. They caught the shells and in the middle of the night, and there was a terrific noise going on, and the dying and the wounded were brought in to my billet, because it was the nearest thing to them. And it was pathetic to see these poor chaps lying on the floors, and some dying and some badly wounded and some not so badly wounded. And all the officers buckled too, because it was in the officers' billet. They were down below, and they all came up And between us, we all soothed them and bandaged them up and gave them a cigarette. They did as that would calm them down and did what we could. And then the ambulance arrived and took them away. And then afterwards, it was rather pathetic because the whole of the tessellated floor was covered in pools of blood. It was rather, and then we had to wipe it or clean it up. It was rather a sad occasion, but that happened frequently.
When you had a casualty, you know, when one of your men died, what did you have to do regarding his belongings and writing to his relatives? Can you remember?
Yes, I remember very clearly. We had to be very punctilious about that. And whichever officer had the character, so to speak, we only had very few, it was his duty to write to the nearest, to collect all his personal belongings and bundle them all together, and they were sent home, and he wrote a personal letter of a sympathetic letter to the wife or the mother or whoever it was. It was a duty which we always did most punctiliously.
How important was comradeship, do you think, at the front, both between yourself and your fellow officers and your relations with the men? Was this very important to you?
Comradeship, I think, was a most important thing, and those batteries that had, those units that had the best comradeship, I think fought best. I'm sure they did. I know we did. And I think it was the comradeship that, under Major Heath, that was so marvellous in our battery that it led, it was largely responsible for the fame that 36 Siege Battery had, to the extent that on two occasions generals came round the battery and said they had told us that they had forbidden any other batteries to fire. Well, because they had allotted us to fire on proximity shoots, which meant on a machine gun or a Minenwerfer, which was worrying the infantry only about 50 or 100 yards in front of their front line, that kind of thing. Because our accuracy was so notable that he could be sure that we wouldn't drop a shot and it would fall amongst our own men. And I put that down to comradeship because every man, in that case, officers and men alike, did all the best they possibly could, and they knew that they would bring credit to Major Heath in charge. And that was the spirit. But then came a complete change when, to quote my personal example, in 36 Siege Battery, I think it may have been the same in other units, when Major Heath was, Major Dean was invalided home, and Captain C.J. Heath, C.J. was a C.J. Heath, took over command. And in any case, he was in command of the left section when the two sections were separated, and the Major was in charge of the right, and he was in charge of the left. C.J. Heath was a very efficient, regular officer in many ways. He was quite a good gunnery man, and he was a very good disciplinarian when he was at his best. At his worst, he was too good, and I was going to say pugnacious, it's not quite the word I mean, but you can suggest a better word than that. And extremely difficult to get on with at all times. And you never knew whether he was going to fly into a rage of a temper for some unimportant thing or not. and we never knew where we were with him. And I'm sorry to say that on some occasions, in the heat of battle, he lost control and...